What is up, you valiant sons? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back with this month's So You're Going to See Shakespeare. The idea of this episode is that it's something that you'll listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, hopefully you'll enjoy this episode as you head out to see Titus Andronicus.
Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into this episode is a quick synopsis of the play so you at least know the story. Daniel,
yes,
take it away.
So, we meet Saturninus and Bassianus, the sons of the recently departed emperor, who both feel they are entitled to inherit the throne. While they debate, Marcus Andronicus enters and declares that the citizens have selected his brother, Titus, to be their new emperor as soon as he gets back from the war. Shortly thereafter, a funeral procession enters, including coffins of 21 of Titus' sons, all of whom were killed in the war against the Goths, or goats, depending on your pronunciation. Mm. Incidentally, he also has several key Goth prisoners of war, the queen, Tamora, her three sons, and Aaron the Moor. Titus allows one of Tamora's sons to be killed by the crowd. Tamora isn't thrilled about this development.
Marcus Andronicus enters with Saturninus and Bassianus and informs Titus that he has been selected as new emperor. Titus tells them, "Nah, I'm good. But since the people do want me to rule and I'm not going to do it, the least I can do is decide who should instead, and I think it should be Saturninus as he's the oldest."
Grumble, grumble,
Saturninus grumble. Is incredibly grateful and as a sign of thanks says he will marry Titus's daughter Lavinia to unite their houses. And that's Titus Andronicus.
Except definitely not. Immediately following Saturninus' pledge to Titus, he goes to release Tamora and falls instantly in love with her.
Mm.
This will almost certainly prove problematic in his impending marriage to Lavinia.
Right.
More problematic, however, is Saturninus' younger brother, Bassianus, seizing Lavinia and fleeing. The rest of Titus' family thinks this actually isn't the worst thing. But Titus calls them all traitors and goes so far as to kill his youngest son for getting in his way. Quick scoreboard update, this leaves three sons of 25 for Titus. With Lavinia out of the picture, Saturninus says he might as well marry Tamora since she's here and he loves her. So he does. Then Bassianus returns and says he's going to marry Lavinia. Titus isn't super thrilled about any of this.
The next day, Aaron the Moor stumbles across Demetrius and Chiron, Tamora's two sons, who are both arguing about how much they want to be with Lavinia. Aaron tells them she'll never go for either of them, so the three of them should probably just go in together and rape her. They all think this is a grand idea.
Oof.
Later on, the three meet up with Tamora and cross paths with the newly betrothed Bassianus and Lavinia. Demetrius and Chiron promptly stab Bassianus and throw him in a pit.
Oof.
Aaron hustles in two of Titus's remaining three sons and tricks them into falling into the pit as well. It's a big pit scene here.
Big pit.
Once they are trapped, Aaron hustles in Saturninus, produces a forged letter making it look like Titus's boys were responsible for Bassianus's death, and demands they be executed. Saturninus forgoes a jury trial and demands they be executed immediately.
Elsewhere, Demetrius and Chiron rape Lavinia, cut off her tongue and hands, and then make fun of her for a while.
Tough day.
After they've abandoned her, Titus' brother Marcus finds her and brings her to Titus, who is still raging against the impending execution of his sons. His mood does not improve upon seeing Lavinia. Despite her shortcomings, she manages to communicate at least a portion of what happened to her.
While they are working things out, Aaron enters with an offer. Saturninus will pardon both of Titus' sons from death row if one of the freemen of the family will cut off his hand and send it to him. Titus does so and gives the hand to Aaron. A little while later, a messenger returns with Titus's hand and the heads of his two sons in a bag as Aaron made the whole thing up and there was no offer in the first place. Titus, no joke, bursts out laughing.
Eventually, Lavinia is able to communicate exactly what happened to her and who did it. Titus swears he will get revenge for Lavinia. And trust us, when Titus promises to get revenge, he gets revenge. You'll see.
The news breaks that Tamara has given birth, but in a bit of a twist, the baby is black, which is only a problem in so much as the fact that there's only one black guy around, and it definitely isn't Tamara's husband, who also happens to be the emperor. Tamara sends the bastard to her sons, Demetrius and Chiron, for them to kill it and hide her indiscretions, but Aaron demands no one harms the baby and goes so far as to kill the nurse who brought it in so that she wouldn't tell anyone that the child was going to live. Instead, Aaron convinces Demetrius and Chiron to sneak a white baby into the castle instead, while he plans on delivering his child to the Goths so it can be raised as a warrior.
Hearing that Titus has gone mad, Tamara, Demetrius, and Chiron go to him dressed as the personifications of revenge, rape, and murder. Titus, feigning madness to some degree, plays along with them, asking revenge to leave rape and murder with him. Tamara, playing revenge, sees no harm in it, which is a mistake because, as with all other things in this play, there is a whole lot of harm in it. Titus kills them as soon as Tamara is gone, then slits their throat and drains the blood from their bodies, as he discusses his dinner plans for the banquet he'll be throwing Tamara the evening.
Titus enters the banquet dressed as a cook and provides dinner for everyone. While they are digging in, Titus opens the dinner conversation by asking Saturninus if it's appropriate for a father to kill his daughter if she was raped. Saturninus thinks so, so Titus immediately kills Lavinia at the dinner table. While Saturninus goes WTF, Titus lays out what Demetrius and Chiron did to her. Saturninus calls for them to be brought in for punishment, at which Titus is like, they're here, and reveals the two of them are actually the meat and the pies that he served to the table that night, and then he preempts Tamara's one-star Yelp review by stabbing her and killing her. Saturninus, in reply, immediately kills Titus. Titus's last remaining son, Lucius, replies by stabbing and killing Saturninus. With the throne empty once again, the people decide Lucius should be king as Titus's son, and as his first act, he takes the high road and decrees that Aaron the Moor should be buried up to the chest and starved to death for all the wrong he did. And that is Titus Andronicus. Now that you know what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where Titus Andronicus falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written. Daniel.
Yes. So there is some debate about when this play was written. So the dates range from anywhere as early as 1589 to anywhere as late. We know that it was definitely written by 1594.
Right.
So what that means for us in terms of some context in Shakespeare's world, at the time, this is early Shakespeare. We're looking at really a young poet, but also the sort of trendy thing happening in the Elizabethan theater scene was the revenge tragedy.
Sure.
Made famous by Thomas Kidd.
Mm-hmm.
But Shakespeare also would have been aware of Tamburlaine, The Jew of Malta by Marlowe. But these revenge tragedies, it was really a lot of passion, murder, vengeance, gore.
Sure.
And one of the big things was pleasure in excess.
Okay.
This idea of, like, as far as we can go, we're going to go for it. And early Shakespeare is described as being an upstart crow, this sort of guy who, like, anything you can do, I can do better. And we get a little glimpse of that in this play where it's like, oh, you want excess? Well, I can do excess excessively.
Right.
And just do all of these passion, murder, vengeance, gore things to the nth degree.
Right.
So that's some early revenge tragedy Shakespeare.
Yeah, and piggybacking on anything you can do, I can do better, there in Kidd's The Spanish Tragedy, which is probably the biggest influence on this play, yeah, relatively, there actually is a character named Revenge that,
oh, wow,
that the scene with Tamara and Demetrius and Chiron putting on the play for Titus seems to be a pretty direct shot at.
Oh, cool.
Except that he kills, well, I guess Revenge gets away, but he kills the other ones.
And Shakespeare brings in two additional characters with the rape and murder.
Right.
So that's...
Right, exactly. Anything you can do, I can do better. This play, you know, speaking of this is what the people wanted, this play was hugely successful in its own time. One of the top money makers, and really put Shakespeare's name on the map in, sure, the community. It was written to be performed at the Rose, and Shakespeare goes out of his way to make use of all of the playing spaces at the Rose, both the balcony, the higher level, the stage level, and also the trap area, as evidenced by the pit. That,
sure,
we,
right.
It's like, now come see Titus Andronicus at the Rose, now featuring a trap.
we have a pit.
Look at how many people I can fit in this trap.
Right.
So that may be the reason why they make there's an entire scene built around this trap.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah. And going back to the idea of the early Shakespeare, when looking at the text, you can see the young poet in terms of a lot of these, the bulk of the play has end stopping lines. Mm-hmm. So the poetry is really sort of blunt and direct. And it's an author writing in 10 syllable units of thought.
Right.
And as he gets older and evolves more as a poet, he'll get better at mixing those up and jamming lines up, or 11 syllable lines, or carrying thoughts over line to line.
Right.
But this is really direct, 10 syllable units. Very regular. But that also does sort of echo the blunt directness of the revenge tragedy.
Sure.
That it's like, this is a locomotive, like driving straight ahead.
Right.
It's not a nuanced, experienced poet who had become. This is like, I can do this. We got this.
Right. Titus is also the only Shakespeare play for which a contemporary drawing survives. The world-famous Peachum drawing, ostensibly drawn by Henry Peachum, shows kind of a mishmash of like several of the major scenes here, but you can Google it, the Peachum drawing. Check it out.
Sounds pretty cool. You talked about Titus being like a big hit in his time. It was not so much a big hit in later periods.
And no.
Edward Ravenscroft says, quote, "This is rather a heap of rubbish than a structure." T.S. Eliot referred to it as one of the stupidest and most uninspired plays ever written.
Go write a poem about a cat.
And Tennessee Williams said this is, quote, "one of the most ridiculous plays."
Cool.
Quote. So there's some love from your other boys.
I have another drink.
But these boys love Titus Andronicus.
All right. Best theme?
Let's do it.
This is where we identify what we consider to be the most prominent themes in the play and particular places where you may see them come up. Dan has chosen his three favorites, and I will take one of those for us to dig in on. Daniel.
Yes.
What are our finalists?
So the finalists for Miss Best Theme in Titus Andronicus are grace, grief, and honor.
Grace, grief.
And honor.
Let's take grief. I think that's interesting to talk about.
All right, nice.
So, we have, I think you see grief in a lot of different ways, and there's a lot more grief than a slasher horror movie that this is really has any license. For the amount of revenge they have, there's also an awful lot of grief, which is a kind of a testament to how much he's able to cram in here, that it's not immediately like, I will revenge this.
Right.
You have the scene where Titus is begging for his sons to not be executed, and nobody's listening despite the fact that he's a hero.
Oh, you are men of stones.
Right.
Yep.
You have him finding Lavinia for scenes working with her and mourning her even alive.
Yeah.
You have Tamara grieving for her son killed in the first scene.
Yep.
Yeah, and in a play and in an era that it would be very easily for everyone to be two-dimensional.
Yes.
Like, we get, especially for Aaron, like, it's so easy for that to just be a cardboard cutout.
Exactly.
And for a lot of the play, kind of is.
Yeah.
Until that. And then you're like, oh, okay.
Oh, shoot, right? Yeah, I think that's part of what makes Shakespeare, is that when you're looking at these other revenge tragedies that he's writing, and it isn't just, I can do, quantifiably more than you, I can make what you do more interesting.
Right.
Shakespeare makes every character justified in their own way through the lens of grief, I think. That's why in that first scene, it is so much about, the honor code and this person has to die. But what in doing so, it sets a mother who watching her son die into a rage.
Right.
It sets the whole play in motion. And then you have, the way that different characters handle their grief at the point where Titus, you mentioned that Titus literally laughs because he has not a tear left to shed.
Right.
I worked on this play several years ago, and the director mentioned we made a point in our production of using a lot of water because so many productions of this use so much blood.
Sure.
But he mentioned that textually the word tears and the image of like salt tears appear much more than blood because these people are grieving.
Yeah.
We begin the play coming back from war.
Right, with 21 dead sons.
Right.
It's like, why couldn't it be like 5? 21.
I think that's the point of like, how much have these people lost?
Yeah.
And in the face of that loss, what are we capable of?
Yeah.
So it does make it much more fleshed out than just like a slasher B movie when you fold in the grief element.
Right.
Which I'm not sure every production will do, but the good productions will.
Yeah, I think it's a trap that it's easy to avoid when you just are like, nope, slasher, cut all this other stuff, let's just get from murder to murder, and you're losing what makes, what separates this from, the Revengers tragedy or whatever.
Exactly.
Exactly. So there you go. Grief, keep an eye out for it when you go out to see Titus Andronicus. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. I won the coin flip before the show, and I've elected to go first, so here we go. For me, there are a lot of opportunities in this play to just be a slasher, and I think that that's, especially in an ensemble, it's when you're working on this show and it's like, oh, we got 20 dudes in a dressing room. Talking about murder, like a real testosterone fest type of situation.
Sure.
Probably some, depending on what level of production you're in, probably a little too dangerous fight choreography going on in here.
Right.
So I'd like to avoid that and be Marcus Andronicus.
Nice.
Because I think he is kind of a beacon of maturity in a sea of chaos.
Sure. Interesting.
And I think especially...
So you'll have to act.
Yes, oh, for certain.
Okay.
It'll be easy. It'll come naturally for me to be above something. But yes, to have that compassion necessary, we'll need to work through. But my favorite thing is actually the relationship between Marcus and Titus.
Oh.
Because...
What about it?
Titus is best general, incredible soldier, legendary, like going to be emperor on the back of his success in the battlefield.
Yeah.
We get no indication that Marcus has any of those skills.
Oh, interesting.
Is Marcus... So, like, what was their childhood like? And, like, they clearly love each other. There is no... I mean, Titus kills one of his sons in this play.
Right.
And it's like, there is no real conflict between the two of them. Clearly, they are on the same page.
Right.
And, the degree of sorrow and grief that Marcus has when he finds Lavinia, it's like almost deeper than Titus. It's certainly as deep and in a different way that he feels the grief in a more human way, in a way that we would.
Marcus does?
I think so.
Okay.
And then Titus Titus feels it as a father, I guess. And maybe it's not that we would, but just like as a audience member.
Right. Well, Marcus's the text there is so beautiful.
Yeah.
That Ovid... some of the best poetry in the whole play.
It's a open-heartedness in the middle of this sea of chaos.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll take Marcus Andronicus.
Be a good Marcus. I support that. For me in this play, since Titus Andronicus is off the board, which I would honestly probably objectively be a great Titus.
Oh, God.
I will... One of the great roles, I think, in the canon I'd like to play is Tamora, Queen of the Goths.
Okay.
Just, I love the power that she has. I really think that she has some of the... That speech that Marcus has may be the best speech, but I think Tamora has some of the best language.
Uh-huh.
Just all these moments that she gets, they're just so strong. The way that she plays everyone. She has such great scenes with Aaron. Aaron the Moor scene is so fun.
Yep.
She has her sons.
Yep.
The revenge scene is so great. I mean, she just has all these great scenes. And I think that it's a ton to dig in on and to chew on. So I'm not sure what the casting of the rest of the show would be like.
Sure.
In a dream world. But I think that she is just one of those roles that's like, what I wouldn't give to play Tamora, Queen of the Goths.
Totally.
So I think, right from the very beginning, in the very first scene, she has that great monologue... stay Roman brethren.
Uh-huh.
When she actually, one of the concedes, like, please just don't. Yes, I might be a queen, and yes, I might be your captive, but I'm a mother first.
Right.
And that is, I think, how she sees herself, how she identifies in the play.
Uh-huh.
And then when you factor that in with the way that she interacts with everyone, I think that makes it a much more appealing character to play than just some sort of, like, crazy-eyed,
right, exactly,
murderous
slasher.
It's like, no, she's a mother, and you ripped away her son in the very beginning,
right? And she's not letting you take any more,
right?
Yeah,
and we see some barbarism, some serious barbarism from the Romans first.
Yeah.
Before we see any of this stuff.
Oh yeah.
So I mean that's where the complication of the revenge part comes in, is that it is her revenge first, and
right.
then it's Titus's revenge later.
Right.
But it's not just like, oh, they're the Goths and they're crazy.
Right.
Like, they're all kind of complicit in this
yeah.
crazy world.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it'd be fun to navigate that world through Tamara's lens.
Yeah, there you go. So those are our recommended roles. Let us know how they are played in this production that you are going to see. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from the play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it in production. The line we chose from Titus Andronicus is, "I'll find a day to massacre them all," from Act 1, Scene 1. Yeah. Let's hear the phrase in context.
"My worthy lord, if ever Tamara were gracious in those princely eyes of thine, then hear me speak indifferently for all. And at my suit, sweet, pardon what is past."
What, madam, be dishonored openly and basely put it up without revenge?
"Not so, my lord. The gods of Rome forfend I should be author to dishonor you. But on mine honor dare I undertake for good Lord Titus innocence in all, whose fury, not dissembled, speaks his griefs. Then at my suit, look graciously on him. Lose not so noble a friend on vain suppose, nor with sour looks afflict his gentle heart. My lord, be ruled by me, be won at last. Dissemble all your griefs and discontents. You are but newly planted in your throne. List then the people, and patricians too, upon a just survey, take Titus' part, and so supplant us for ingratitude, which Rome reputes to be a heinous sin. Yield at entreats, and then let me alone. I'll find a day to massacre them all, and race their faction and their family, the cruel father and his traitorous sons, to whom I sued for my dear son's life, and make them know what 'tis to let a queen kneel in the streets and beg for grace in vain."
That was "I'll Find a Day to Massacre Them All" from Act 1, Scene 1 of Titus.
Yes.
Daniel, you want to give us a little context on this?
Sure. This is sort of the first advisor meeting for the new emperor, Saturninus, where Tamara has, in the early action, she's asked them not to kill her son Alarbus. They've killed Alarbus.
Yep.
She got very upset. We're going to take Lavinia for a queen. Decided, nah, I'll take Tamara instead. Saturninus releases Tamara and is like, "You're the new queen." And in this moment, Saturninus is getting tetchy with the Andronici.
Sure.
And he's seeming, and this is actually a really great introduction of a lot of the themes, where she's like, "Listen, this is Rome. I'm not trying to like embarrass you. You're the emperor. You're the guy in charge. I'm just here. I'm just seeing what I see. Let's not be..." Like, gratitude is really important.
Yeah.
Honor is really important.
Yeah.
"So let's just play by the rules for now. Give me some time. And you are the king, and I am the queen, and we will find a time, not here in front of all these public people, we will find the right moment to just massacre them all.
To just end it violently."
So you see her kind of come up and be like, playing everybody just right.
Right.
And I think this is actually the moment where Saturninus is like, "Oh, yes.
Hey, yo.
Hey, I had picked the right..." They made the right choice here.
Right, and it's a great introduction to Tamara, both as, like, clearly she has some degree of seduction at her beck and call, but also, like, a warrior.
Yeah.
You know, not... She's not saying, "You'll find a way." It's like, "I will massacre them all. Me.
Yeah.
Tamara.
Right.
Call me Tammy. I'm going to kill everybody."
Right.
And it really gives her that, you're like, "Oh yeah, okay.
Right.
We're on."
I think there's a difference between, you know, "The day will come that I'll massacre them all."
Right.
And "I'll find a day."
Right.
Like, that from this point forward, I'm on the hunt.
I'm looking and I'm waiting.
Yeah. You know, in this wilderness of tigers.
Yeah.
I'm number one tiger.
Yeah.
Like, I'm out there. They're going to think, like, they will not sleep peacefully.
Right.
I won't sleep peacefully.
Right.
Until they're all dead.
It may look like I am, but I'm not.
Right.
I will. Je me souviens.
Let's just get out of this room right now.
Right.
And do this the smart way.
Right. No one gets hurt.
Right
now.
Except for everyone later.
Except for everyone later. and it's a great, I mean, the line by itself, especially in Act 1, Scene 1, we don't usually have lines from that early, but it's like, it kind of does set the tone for the whole play, that it's like, you know, we have grief, we have revenge, we have all these, you know what we don't have a lot of in this play? Forgiveness.
Forgiveness.
Not happening here.
Can you imagine?
Not tonight.
Absolutely not.
So
we do get a little bit in that speech, too, of, as I was mentioning earlier, the end stopping. Each line really is sort of its own little unit of thought.
Right.
The gods of Rome forfend. I should be author to dishonor you. But on my honor dare I undertake for good Lord Titus' innocence and all. Like, these are like really clear, clean. And then the line itself, I just love and make them know what 'tis to let a queen kneel in the streets and beg for grace in vain.
Right.
20 beats, 20 words. Her heartbeat is, in the first speech, she's, you know, it's a little more skippy, a little more bouncing around because her son is going to get killed.
Right.
But here it's like, okay, that's over.
Right.
I'm bringing my heartbeat back down and I need you two with me.
Yeah.
Let's just all breathe here and then later we'll spike this thing up.
Right.
But the scansion there is, it reflects, you know, what she's after, which is just like deep breaths. Deep breaths.
Focus.
Not, you know, and Saturninus is so unpredictable.
Yeah.
And that's something, he's newly in power. He's so hungry for power.
Yeah.
And now he has it. And he's like, I want to just kill everyone.
Yeah.
And she's like, so do I. But not right now.
Right. Exactly.
So it's a really nice power dynamic.
Yeah. And as an audience member, you know, we talk about these lines is when you can squeeze your date's hand.
Yeah.
It's an interesting place to be like, whoa. This is on.
And it's kind of like a sexy, like, we're in this together, and the right time will come. But it's maybe not right now, but maybe later tonight.
Because you're sitting in a theater.
Because we're sitting, right. But maybe we can sneak a little, like, hanky-panky in an intermission, and then when we get home, we'll massacre them all.
Okay, let's go to the challenge route.
Okay.
Here, we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For Titus Andronicus, we think the biggest challenge is the stage direction, enter Lavinia, ravished, her hands cut off, and her tongue cut out, from Act 2, Scene 4. Mm. Dan,
yeah,
a little context.
This is when Lavinia comes back after her encounter with Demetrius and Chiron. Marcus Andronicus finds her, and as mentioned in the text, she comes in ravished, sans tongue, sans hands.
Hmm.
So it's pretty straightforward. This is actually straightforward. When we were talking about this whole idea for an episode, one of the examples of like, oh, the challenge, like, you know,
oh, right.
How do you handle Lavinia?
So you're like, going to see Shakespeare's as a concept.
Yeah, yeah. This was one of the, like, and this is... It's in the same way of like when you're doing Lear, like, oh, how are you going to do the eyes?
Right, or how are you going to do the bear in Winter's Tale?
Right.
Like, this is the donkey head. It's like a top five.
Oh, yeah.
Challenge.
Yeah, because it's more than just how do you handle one entrance. It really is a bigger question.
Right, because she's, obviously she doesn't regenerate, so now you have someone for the rest of the play with no hands.
Right.
No tongue.
And it's a chance for the director to establish how are we going to handle the violence in the play.
Right.
What is the visual aesthetic of the play?
Yeah.
This is, if you do a cursory Google search of any production of Titus, you'll probably see a picture of this entrance.
Yeah, exactly. Right, because you can't have Lavinia's tongue be like a handkerchief and then later on cut Demetrius's neck and have like 2 gallons of stage blood.
Right.
It's like you can't mix and match your metaphors.
Right.
You set it here and forget it, hopefully, on the drive home because it's going to be a horror movie. But like, how are you going to... Where is this going to go? So how have you seen this done in the productions that you've seen?
Sure. You mentioned a handkerchief. I believe there was a production I saw at the Public.
Yeah, I think so.
Which they did similar, like the red ribbons.
Yes, it was handkerchiefs. If I remember correctly, handkerchiefs or ribbons on the wrists.
Yeah.
And then for her tongue, it was just like, the thing that I'm picturing, it worked. It was very effective in the theater, but the only way I can describe it is that thing that clowns do where they pull a whole ribbon out of their mouth.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like she just reached into her mouth and pulled out this ribbon that ended up being like 6 feet long. And it was just one thick, you know, 2-inch thick fire engine red ribbon just coming out of her mouth for a long time.
Right.
While Marcus was watching her, and it's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was, I mean, that was a production where they didn't use any blood at all.
Yeah.
And that's not true. There was some, they did the Sweeney Todd thing where there was literally a bucket of blood.
Oh. And Sweeney Todd revival.
Sweeney Todd revival. Where, and then someone would walk across and pour it from one basin into the other, but it was just two buckets of blood. But yeah, that was a pretty easy cleanup in the grand scheme of things.
Sure.
Titus.
In the production I was in, which took place in what was once an old parking garage. So the architecture of the space was very concrete.
Sure.
Very stone, very rock. And in that production, the director, great director, David Gammons, focused on, like I mentioned, tears and salt water more than blood. So we used water for everything.
Huh.
So when, you know, we it was actually great because we could have buckets and buckets and buckets of water.
Yeah.
So people were wet, but there was no blood to clean up.
Right,
the
cleanup is fine, yeah.
Just let it dry.
Yeah.
But for this scene with Lavinia, when she came in, because the architecture was so much stone and rock, we actually, in the early days of rehearsal, we were using like wrenches and tire irons for all the violence. And then David came in and was like, it doesn't fit the world. Uh-huh. Like, it was a parking garage, but I don't care about cars. I care about stone.
Right.
I care about like that, like how hard it is.
Yeah.
So what he did was we used some sort of like foam material, but it looked like rocks. And the actor, it was an all male production. So Paul, who played Lavinia, had a large rock stuffed in his mouth.
Okay.
And then his hands, he had to hold these like boulders. So his mouth and hands actually got bigger.
Uh-huh.
Even though it was like they were taken away from Lavinia.
Right.
But they were just, he couldn't do anything with anything.
Right.
And his mouth was open for like 2 hours. Whoa. It was pretty
brutal
to see. But it was also just a stunning visual of like, I have rocks now for him. Like I can't, that image of like, I can't grab anything because I just have stupid stones for hands.
Right.
It was a really powerful and effective way to handle it, I think.
Yeah. And then, of course, if you have the budget for it, you can just go full Dexter and just make it like American Psycho, bloodbath, lay down the tarps, and just, you absolutely can go almost, you know, there is a whole school of thought that this can be done as a comedy.
Yeah.
Because the violence is so over the top, and you just basically turn it into a farce, like that Evil Dead musical, and it's just like, first three rows may get blood on them because there's so much blood. Here we go. All right.
Right. I feel like I've always wanted to see this done in sort of like a butcher block.
Right.
Just really like thinking Dexter, like there are just meat everywhere.
Yeah.
So I would love to direct a production where basically you turn Lavinia's hands into like pork tenderloins.
Interesting.
You just like wrap meat around and then have like that ribbon that you get on a pork tenderloin.
Yeah.
And then just to basically steal wholesale Gammon's idea and have like a steak in her mouth for the whole play. Because I mean, that's how Demetrius and Chiron see Lavinia.
As a piece of meat?
Totally. Mm. And it's awful.
Yeah.
So I think it would take a long, hard... And it's an image that you... The beauty of the image making it so striking is that you have to look at it for like an hour and a half.
Right.
It isn't just there and gone. It's like... Right. Nope. It's shocking when you see it and then you sit with it.
Right.
Which is what I'd want to find the most uncomfortable thing to sit with.
Totally. Yep. So there you go. Keep an eye out for that and let us know the vocabulary of violence in this production that you're going to see. All right, that is going to do it for this episode. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review in iTunes so we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can Patreon us at patreon.com/noholdsbarred. You can tweet us at noholdsbardcast or Facebook us at facebook.com/noholdsbardcast. Until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Bollier.
Her life was beastly and devoid of pity.
And being dead, let birds on her take pity.
Adieu, 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 adieu.